Coming up on Tech Nation, it's a breakthrough collaboration between Children's National Medical Center and HemoShear Therapeutics. We talk about an unprecedented activity around a young girl and her rare disease. It's engineering, science, medicine, and human endeavor at its best, looking beyond to what might change how we look for new treatments and new drugs. Then Inflection Biosciences, a startup which is doing a startup differently. Headquartered in Dublin, Ireland, its first target is lung cancer. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In John Patrick's Tech Nation interview about his book, Health Attitude, he mentions the challenges of implementing information systems in our healthcare environments. What struck me immediately was his description of complaints from people because their doctors had their faces buried in a laptop when they felt the doctor should have been talking to them. I've heard this complaint before, and in retrospect, I realized that I'd only heard it from people of older generations, minimally computer savvy, and not particularly information savvy, which is likely to be more germane for everything in the years to come. I have no anecdotal input whatsoever from younger people. Then again, they either don't need to go to the doctor, or maybe they're checking their text messages while the doctor is checking their health records. More importantly, it's one thing to redesign a system because people complain, but before we do, let's get to the bottom of why they're complaining. I have a friend who's quite umbrage that her grandchildren won't pick up the phone and call her, while they text her husband all the time and even send photos. She has a simple cell phone, which she only uses when she travels, and it's anything but smart. Most of the time, she has it turned off. Even through the complaints, she continues to refuse to get a better phone and to get into texting, insistent that getting email on her stationary computer was a major concession. Quizzing her further, I got an interesting picture. She doesn't see text communication as real. She doesn't get that texting can be done at any time, whether or not the person being texted is home or awake or busy doing something else. He doesn't see that it's done both on her grandchildren's time and her husband's time. And this doesn't have to be the same time as in calling grandma. Here may be a clue as to why people object to the doctor interacting with the computer instead of paying attention to them. Of course, I might not be the right person to diagnose this condition. You see, I love it. My doctor has the screen angled so he can easily turn it from it to me. And I'm amazed at the amount of information he has at his fingertips. The last time I was in there, he said, "You know, you're due for this test. Do you have time to do that today?" A few more taps on the keyboard, and he said, "How about 4:30, 4:45? That sounded good, as it was just getting on to 4, and it was in the same building. The people who are uncomfortable with doctors and their computers have just spent a lifetime where seeing your doctor face-to-face was the most important medical connection possible. And today it's a major challenge to even get in to see him. Like my friend and her grandchildren's text, it's entirely possible that they don't see what's going on. They don't have the concept that I do, that there is a complete picture of me inside that computer, a much larger picture that could be in any manila folder or on any clipboard or even in my doctor's brain. What may be needed here is to change the perception of people who don't use smartphones and all that much of the internet, that don't comprehend big data and analytics. And that's not a technical challenge. That's a human one. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, it's a Biotech Nation special with a breakthrough effort between Children's National Medical Center and HemoShear Therapeutics. We talk about their work with a young girl and her rare disease. Then it's Inflection Biosciences from Dublin, Ireland, a startup with a different way of doing things. First up, lung cancer. Dr. Marshall Summer is the Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National Medical Center. Jim Powers is the Chairman and CEO of HemoShear Therapeutics in Charlottesville, Virginia. Today we're talking about their unprecedented collaboration. Well, gentlemen, welcome to NPR. Welcome to NPR headquarters. Pretty fun here, huh?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Maurice. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, we're going to be talking about a collaboration today, so I thought we'd better start with each of your endeavors and then bring that together. First of all, Marshall, you are Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at the Children's National Medical Center and the Margaret O'Malley Chair of Molecular Genetics there. You have genetics written all over you.
Well, I've been doing it since really the 1970s, so trained in molecular biology and then did pediatrics and medical school and then came back to the field of genetics and started working in the late 80s, early 90s there with the Human Genome Project and gene mapping over the years, and I was at Vanderbilt for about 20 years doing that and then moved up to D.C. about 5 years ago.
I think a lot of people don't know the Children's National Medical Center. Let's go there.
Yeah, it's the independent freestanding children's hospital in Washington, D.C. We have tight affiliations with George Washington University. We do a lot of work with Georgetown. We do a whole lot of work with the NIH. We sort of supply the children's health care for about a 6 million patient area in Northern Virginia, Southern Maryland, those areas.
And what do you do in genetics and metabolism, and why is that connected together?
Well, what we do, if you look at any list of diseases, specialties, anything, the biggest category is always other. We're other. So we see the children with Down syndrome. We see the children with defects in newborn screening. We follow them up, PKU, which phenylketonuria, some folks may or may not know. So all of those 7,000 different rare genetic conditions, we're the ones that are charged with diagnosing them and taking care of them.
So now you got involved with these HemoShear folks from Charlottesville, huh?
Right. Well, what happened is we contacted Virginia Biotech. They have sort of a omnibus organization there that tries to make connections between researchers, companies. And a lot of the work we'd been doing at Children's involved around trying to come up with practical ways to study metabolic disease. And let me just take a second and explain what I mean by metabolic disease, because it means a lot of different things to different folks. If any of you remember ever studying biochemistry and falling asleep in the middle of the class, that's what we do. So we take all of those different pathways, all of those different little molecules going from A to B, and we work with children who can't get A to B, and there's all kinds of implications. Some of these are deadly serious. Some of them are easily treatable if we recognize them in time, and we've been working with developing new treatment methods for years and years. But we'd found that we were starting to run into walls. A lot of the animal models that we use for other diseases don't work very well.
And by that, we mean, like, if you were doing hepatitis C, you'd do a woodchuck. If you do, I mean, it's like, what's the pigs are very right. similar for insulin. But well, for these, no.
Yeah. Part of the problem is if you, let's take the mouse. The mouse is probably one of the most commonly used research animals. That's sort of like comparing a supernova sun to a slow-burning coal, comparing the metabolic rate of a mouse to that of a human. You know, mice only last a couple of years. You know, it runs very hot. So anytime we tried to make models for a lot of these diseases, we ended up with, unfortunately, dead mice. They just can't support having any derangement at all in these metabolic pathways. So when we were looking at our patients and trying to find some way to study them, we were really running into just a lot of barriers. And we'd heard about this company, HemoShear, down in Charlottesville that had this way to use human cells and keep them in a state where they behave just like they were back in the body. And we thought, oh, what a great way that would be to model some of these metabolic diseases we work with. Maybe we can figure something out there. So we called him up, made the drive down the road. We all kind of looked across the table at each other, kind of going, who the heck are you and what's biochemical genetics? And
biochemical genetics.
Yeah. And then the conversation got deeper, and that it's really led to one of the most delightful collaborations I've ever had.
Well, I met you guys all together, and I have to say, I didn't realize that you didn't know each other before. I thought you guys maybe grew up together. So it's more than a collaboration now. It's merged.
It was one of those scientific love at first sight kind of things.
Yeah, we actually like each other.
Yeah. There you go.
Yes.
Well, let's turn to you, Jim. You're one of the co-founders, chairman, and CEO of HemoShare, now HemoShare Therapeutics. Tell us about this platform technology that it started with.
It's very exciting, and it's kind of a fun story, Moira. So I'll never forget, I was retired, and after having had a career in clinical research and running clinical trials for pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies and watching all the failure that happens once a drug goes into a human, and you may or may not know that 9 out of 10 drugs that go into humans fail during clinical trials, either because the drug is no better than another drug already out there, or it doesn't work at all, or it's unsafe.
But it worked in the animals.
And it worked in the animals and in these little cell cultures where you try to manipulate cells and predict what's going to happen in a human in a dish, which we know leads to very high rates of failure. And so I got a call from one of the co-founding scientists of HemoShare, who said, you know, Jim, we think we have a science that could predict how a human will respond to a drug before a drug ever goes into a human. And I thought, my gosh, that's science fiction. That's impossible. And he began to explain how it was done on the phone. I thought, wow, that's interesting. And I was in the process of building my retirement home at the time, and my wife is listening to this conversation,
she
rolling
said, no,
her eyes
no.
and said, Jim, are you thinking about going back to work? And I said, really, I'm just going to be a pain in the neck anyway, and I'm way too young to retire. And I actually think these guys are onto something that could transform the way drug discovery is done. And so that was sort of the beginning of my involvement with the science. And to talk about the science a little bit, so you have two faculty members at the University of Virginia. All they were trying to do at the time was just create a better model to help them do their research that was more human relevant. And typically, scientists work with cells in isolation, so the neighboring cells aren't even there that they are accustomed to living with in the human body. Or as we've already talked about, scientists work with rats, dogs, monkeys, none of which, I know a few humans who may be rats, but generally speaking, and it's not the other way around. And we know that those models are very poor predictors of human response, and trying to understand human biology in another species is challenging and often misleading. And so it turns out that principles of flow are really, really important in human biology.
Am I talking about physics here?
Well,
yeah, you're talking blood flow and pressure waves, the whole nine yards.
And you are. So think about our arteries, capillaries, tissue, organs, cells. Everything in our body has either blood or fluid moving around it, over it, through it, in it. And think about, if flow was shut down in you and Marshall and I, we'd be laying on the floor, right? We would. And so when tissue, human cells, are taken out of a body and cultured in a dish and removed from those very important physiological cues, that biology is instantly changed. And believe it or not, that's one of the best research methods, albeit as misleading as it is. So they figured out a way, using engineering principles and fluid mechanics and mathematics, to restore principles of flow to human tissue in the laboratory to bring back its biology. And for the first time, deeply understand how certain organ biology works, how certain diseases work, in a way that could never be done before, and study drugs in a human-relevant disease model that very closely approximates a human condition and predict which of those chemistries or drug modalities would actually succeed in a human. And so that's the science that they created.
And to be clear, we've got two elements here, not just isolating a single cell and throwing a bunch of drugs at it, which has been typical. It's been typical practice. It's like taking companion cells as well as restoring flow around it so it has an environment that emulates what's in the body.
Right. So its neighboring cell types are all there, and we basically recreated sort of the microarchitecture of human tissue in the laboratory. So, yes, so the companion cell types are an extremely important part of the picture.
When we went down to visit them, most of my work's been around liver biology, and one of the problems is you take a liver cell and you plop it down in a culture plate. Within about 2 days, it looks like a skin cell. It just loses its liverness, shall we say. And so when we heard about this tech, we were kind of interested, okay, so maintaining a pressure flow on the cell and, you know, putting it in the right structure is going to maintain it in a differentiated state. And so we went down to take a look at it, and dadgum, it actually really did. I mean, we looked at the, you know, ammonia processing functions, all the things that the liver does for housekeeping that are unique just to the liver, and they were maintaining all of those functions in spite of these cells not being in the body, which was the fascinating thing to me. The other issue that comes up when we look at liver cells and other cells in culture is we have to create a very artificial media for these things to even grow. We have to give them amounts of either amino acids or hormones that they would never see biologically. And what they were able to do was actually throw most of that out the door so that actually what the cells were being fed and what the cells were growing on resembled almost directly what they would see in the body. And that opened up huge possibilities because suddenly you could start looking at subtleties of, you know, you do this, you probe the cell with this a little bit to see how it reacts. Obviously for drug testing, that's a huge issue.
For drug testing new drugs, but also for you testing your patients.
Yeah, exactly so.
And here's the fun part of the story. And is, if you remember, Marshall, we came to you. You didn't come to us for the very first meeting.
I thought we reached
and,
out.
And,
I love
and
it.
No,
your first fight.
No. You,
this is our
no, no, you did. You did reach out, but I'm saying physically,
okay,
you know,
physically,
you're
yes.
a very busy guy. And so we came up to see you and the children that you treat. Children's National Medical Center, by the way.
No, you know, fisticuffs, boys.
No, not at all. We're in, that's what good friends, you know. And so and luckily we're only a 2-hour drive away. So Marshall and his staff are with us every 2 weeks. So we're visiting with Marshall. And the fun story is, and we came up to present the science in our early days at Hemosphere Therapeutics. We always thought that there would be applications in rare diseases. And when you think about how expensive drug discovery is, and you take very tiny populations of patients, and how fraught with failure drug discovery is, it's no wonder that nobody has been working in those areas for so many years until we came along and our ability to recreate these diseases. And I'll never forget Marshall, just as he's sitting here now with his shirt sleeves rolled up and, you know, sitting in a very relaxed manner on a big table in a very, you know, claustrophobic conference room, and his legs are spread and he's leaning forward and he sees a picture that we had drawn of our ability to recreate the urea cycle, which is a very important metabolic process in the liver. And he said, "I've never seen this before." And he said, "Do you know that there's a rare disease called urea cycle disorder?" And it was like, we had no idea. And, you know, and part of creating a business and succeeding is serendipity, right? When you just, the moons are aligned and you meet the right people who are as motivated as you are, who bring an expertise very complementary to your expertise. And so Marshall then went on to describe a whole group of other rare diseases and said, you know, people are pretty busy in the urea cycle space, but there's this whole other group of diseases where children often die very young and will rarely get past their 20s that is completely untreated, no drugs exist, and these children have no alternatives. He said, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could figure out a way to go after these diseases.
Yeah.
And so that began.
That was it, yeah.
That began the you remember that, Marshall?
I do remember that,
yeah.
That you're agreeing.
Oh, yeah. we agree on 99.9%.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guests today are Dr. Marshall Sommer, Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National Medical Center, where he also holds the Margaret O'Malley Chair of Molecular Genetics, and Jim Powers, the Chairman and CEO of HemoShare Therapeutics in Charlottesville, Virginia.
One of the things that, you know, I think Jim brought up, and then everyone thinks about, you say, okay, rare disease. Well, we're never going to see these things. You know, they're just not around that much. But like I said earlier, the kind of one of the biggest categories in any survey is other. And right now, these rare conditions probably affect about 8% roughly. That's the NIH's best guess number on how what size of the population. So you're talking literally millions of Americans who have some form of a rare disease. The biochemicals are a special subgroup. But the impact on healthcare of these things is huge. If you go through any hospital, there's a great study done at Rainbow Babies in Cleveland a few years ago. They looked at all the patients in the hospital for a given year. And what they found is about 35 to 40% of those patients had some genetic condition that was why they were in the hospital. But what they looked at also is what of the hospital bills that represented. That represented almost 60%
really?
Of the hospital bills. So if you think about it, kids are intrinsically healthy. You know, if you think
it's as old people that
yeah, exactly. We suck up all the oxygen. If you think about it, though, unless a child's got something pretty seriously wrong, and infectious disease obviously is still in the biggest categories, and asthma, things like that. But after that, there are rare things: congenital heart defects, rare cancers, rare immune defects, kidney diseases. All of these are in that category of rare conditions, almost all of them with a genetic background on that. So finding ways to kind of start picking at this and finding ways that we're going to start looking at, it's not only important for the individual patients, absolutely is, but what we can look at from the overall health care for our younger population, it's a huge impact. So when we looked at Jim's company and what they were able to do with that, it was just obviously very exciting for us because we don't have that many ways to study this. And this led to kind of our big idea. So let me tell you a little bit about what happened. So for some of the rare metabolic conditions we look at, the kids really just can't survive without these biochemistry pathways intact. And so for a lot of them, liver transplant's really the only option. And there's two kind of categories that we do a lot of these. One are called organic acidemias, which doesn't help your audience much. It's not something you get at a Whole Foods or something like that. These are basically acidic compounds that you would normally never see in the bloodstream. Normally they're broken down from A to B to C to D to E, but there's a block in that system. So suddenly C or D builds up where it normally never would and has a lot of nasty consequences. So what we found is for some of those patients, we can stabilize them medically. We pick these up by newborn screening. But to keep them alive long term, we have to do a liver transplant. Well, normally that liver that we take out of that patient, we throw in the bucket. That's literally billions of cells that have that rare genetic defect. And what occurred to us when we were sitting around talking with Jim and the team at HemaShare was that could we actually use those livers that were coming out of these patients we were transplanting as a way to study not only what was going on in the biology of that disease in the human cell, but also start to test therapeutic options in a way we'd never really been able to do before. And we actually did that for the first time this summer. So we had a patient with something called propionic acidemia, delightful young lady who her liver came up for her transplant. And then we called everyone together. So in about a two-hour window, we had to organize people from about four different cities, getting people to get the cells isolated, get them transported from where we were doing the transplant to the lab to prep the cells to HemaShare. And I think you had an all-hands-on-deck.
We did.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like all things, this happened, of course, around 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. So
yeah.
I think we ruined everybody's weekend plans on that. And
it was such a great story, Marshall. And I remember it vividly because it was a highly emotional time for us. So typically, when we get human tissue and we run studies on human tissue, it's an anonymous donor. That we really, all we know is that they're a diabetic, non-diabetic, smoker, non-smoker, age, sex, you know, and that's and a little bit more information than that. That's all. In this case, our staff had actually met this little girl, and who's an 8-year-old little girl. And when we were notified that there would be a liver transplant and the liver tissue would be made available to us for the first time, we were able to work with a human being that we actually knew, which happened to be a young child. And it was a highly emotional experience. So the transplant happened on a Friday. The liver was flown to North Carolina to a partner of ours that isolated the cells for us, and the cells were driven up. So by 4 a.m. Saturday morning, the cells from the liver, from her diseased liver, were delivered to us. And we had a staff that worked through the weekend to culture her cells on our platform. And over a span of 3 weeks, we had 31 of our sort of mini disease systems recreating, restoring the biology of her disease. And we had a well-planned set of protocols that were all designed to interrogate how the disease biology works and where we might intervene with a drug strategy that could extend her life and potentially cure the disease. And there were some tears because it was a highly, highly emotional experience for all of our staff. And during the process, and we successfully cultured her cells and restored her disease, Marshall texted us and said, "Guys, this is the first time in history that this disease had been restored in a laboratory platform." And so we went on, and one of the very cool experiments that was done, so when children like this eat a normal diet, because they can't process food properly, they suffer very high levels of very bad things like ammonia and other toxins. So one of the key experiments was to feed the cells a diet similar to what this young lady would ingest in hope to see similarly elevated levels of toxins like ammonia and other toxins. And sure enough, we saw that. And it was kind of a eureka moment when we realized that we had not only a disease model, but a biologically responsive disease model. And when you remove the diet, the ammonia levels go back down. We had a fully functional disease model, and Marshall then organized a call for us where we briefed a number of other transplant physicians and clinicians who see other patients like this around the country at major university hospitals, and we shared our data with them. Was it around the world?
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Dr. Marshall Sommer from Children's National Medical Center and Jim Powers, chairman and CEO of HemoShear Therapeutics. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, we'll hear more from Dr. Marshall Sommer and Jim Powers, and then Inflection Sciences, a startup headquartered in Dublin, Ireland, with its first focus on lung cancer. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation and a special full hour of Biotech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Marshall Sommer, Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National Medical Center, and Jim Powers, the Chairman and CEO of HemoShear Therapeutics.
We had a fully functional disease model, and Marshall then organized a call for us where we briefed a number of other transplant physicians who and clinicians who see other patients like this around the country at major university hospitals, and we shared
our data with them.
Was it around the world?
Yeah.
Who all agreed that, first of all, they were blown away by the data and what we're able to do, and agreed that we had developed the first biologically responsive model of the disease. And so what it allowed us to do was to look at different ways of potentially directly going after the mutation in this disease, or going elsewhere in the stream of biology to potentially shut down a pathway that would negate the effects of her mutation. And these different strategies are the basis for our drug discovery programs that are going on right now. In fact, from the data that we received and generated from this little girl's tissue, we will actually be looking at drug candidates as early as the first quarter of next year. And our goal over a 2 to 3 year period is to have this little girl in a clinical. So now she has a new liver. The problem is her mutation still exists
right,
in her body.
Right, it's still in every other cell in her body.
Yeah. And so she has maybe another, 6 to 10 years to live, and, maybe a little bit more. But our goal is to have her in a clinical trial on a drug that we will have discovered together.
Yeah. It's what was fun is when we took this to some of our colleagues at other centers, this was the easiest cell I've ever had to get a collaboration. In fact, Pittsburgh has already sent us a liver from a patient with the same disease mm-hmm. already, and we've been able to now do this twice. And we're working with the teams in Zurich, Stanford, all over the place on this. So it's one of those nice community efforts where everyone sees the advantage on coming through with this. And I'd like to say this was an acceleration on what we're doing, but this wasn't something we could do before, so this is kind of uncharted territory for us.
We call that a discrete shift. Boom.
There you go.
New level.
We have a very discrete shift. So the acceleration process, it's not just, you said use the word serendipity earlier. A lot of the treatments for rare conditions have resulted from serendipity. Somebody had an idea. They tried to figure out a way to test it out. And that works well, but of these 7,000 conditions we have, we only have treatments for about 300 or 400. What we've got with this system, at least for the kids we can get the liver cells from, is a way to systematically tackle this. We can look at everything around the defect. We can do it in an affordable but also a meaningful way to look at this. So we can probe above, we can probe below, we can probe to the side. And when you deal with these biochemical pathways, it's kind of like playing a game like Go or something like that, because when you move one pebble, a lot of other things happen. And so if you can't test that out in something that's biologically relevant, you don't know if what you're trying to do is safe, effective, or anything. So it gave us engineers will kind of love this. And actually, I think of you guys almost more as engineers than anything. Mm-hmm. It gives you a test bed in which you can kind of go in and say, okay, how is this going to actually play out?
A total system test bed, or
exactly.
A larger view of the total system. I have a couple of questions here. Can you take just part of a liver out and do this?
So for some of our patients, we do partial liver transplants. And those are usually from either living-related donors. Mom or dad will donate a chunk of their working liver because of the immune tolerance issues. That's a lot better sometimes to do it that way, although technically challenging. So we can take out a part of the liver. We probably at this point can't do something as small as a liver biopsy because we need a fair number of cells to really use in this system. But we're exploring some actually unique ways beyond this. So for almost all of our patients, whether they ever need a liver transplant or not, we have skin cells. It's very easy to get a little piece of skin and grow it up in the laboratory. And there are some technologies in where you create what are called pluripotent stem cells, and this has been around now for about 5-10 years. And you can take those cells backwards in time and differentiation and then bring them forward where they try to think they're liver cells. Now, this isn't as good as having actual liver cells because it's a pretty close approximation. And I think it's getting better and better. And what we're looking at now is how do those cells behave when you put them into this HemaShare system. And I think the data is looking promising that they look a lot like liver cells. Maybe not quite, but 90%+ there. So that gives us, we go now from just patients getting liver transplant, which is a tough procedure to do. It's really a tough procedure, to now almost any patient we're seeing with any genetic condition that affects the liver. And that, to me, is very, very exciting. And we've also been playing with some very novel ways, and they've got a great molecular biology team at HemaShare on knocking down selective genes. So we can take a gene in a particular pathway and then reduce its function to the point where it becomes biologically significant. And that's useful not only for studying treatment potentials, but also for creating other diseases that we wouldn't normally transplant a patient for that we can now study.
Go over that again. That's interesting.
Sure.
So you're saying I'm going to reverse or cycle back this cell and say, now let's create a disease that we know of so we can study it?
Correct. So in other words, there's two kind of models for that. One is we take cells from a patient who has that genetic condition, so that it's hardwired into all the cells. We walk those cells back in their differential time stream until they're sort of more like a stem cell. And then we try to bring them forward as a liver cell. So, you know, you take them back past a couple of branch points in differentiation.
Well, remember, we all started out as a cell.
Exactly.
And ended up this.
Yeah. Somehow.
Yeah.
So we try to walk them back in biologic time and then try to walk them down a different pathway into becoming a liver cell. And that's a technology that's been used a lot of different places. But the end-stage cells still weren't as differentiated as a liver cell. A lot of that's because they were just in a standard culture. So what's kind of fun now is to see how these cells may behave in the HemaShare system, which then allows us to tackle almost any patient we have with that. And they also have models for vascular biology and other things. So, you know, diseases like Marfan syndrome, which is one that affects your vascular integrity and your ability to keep your blood vessels intact. And there's so many different things we can tackle using this methodology that I think, you know, job security for whoever's working with this is not going to be a big issue.
Yeah.
It's going to be actually more choosing our targets than anything else. So the other one we were talking about a second ago is, let's say we don't have cells from a patient with a defect, or we want to create a defect to see how it acts with the other. There are different ways you can add in some different types of modified RNA molecules, different things like that, that will then find a gene and target its product and, you know, knock it down to the point where it becomes, you know, biologically or clinically significant in that cell. And that's a little harder to do. And then, of course, there's all the new gene modification techniques like the CRISPRs and things like the CRISPR-Cas9 and things like that. So we've got a lot of tools now that we can actually bring to the system.
And you just got to decide what you're going to do next.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and here's
exactly
the fun part, Moira, I think. Interestingly, in this disease group of organic acidemias, many of these diseases are on very similar or share the same pathways. And it's quite possible that discovery of an effective, safe therapeutic that treats one of these diseases will actually resolve several other diseases. And so one is we have the byproduct of potentially having a treatment, if not a cure, for multiple diseases. But this creates a whole new paradigm in being able to obtain tissue from patients and recreate nearly any disease of the liver. And our focus happens to be on children's rare diseases, and that's where we'll stay for a while, because there's a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of young children and families that we can help. And so our plan is to stay in that space. But this is kind of a new paradigm that we can show the rest of the industry. Why wouldn't you develop a drug with a human-relevant disease, no matter what the disease is? And why do we have to rely so much on rats and dogs and monkeys, which we know are very misleading, whose biology is not human, while we've demonstrated an ability to recreate human disease biology? And why not do all that in a human-relevant system in the laboratory and not waste so much time on animal studies?
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Dr. Marshall Sommer from Children's National Medical Center, where he also holds the Margaret O'Malley Chair of Molecular Genetics, and Jim Powers from HemaShare Therapeutics. Jim, logistically, we need all these cells because, and I'm just making this up here because I hope I'm, you'll tell me what's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's like, for every one of these things we want to study, whether it's introducing a drug into it or feeding it a diet, you have to set up sort of a different experiment with mm-hmm. the same cells. So you've got to be able to take the cells and grow and grow and grow them so you have enough for each of the experiments.
Yes.
And for our young girl, how many different experiments did you put together?
Well, there were for her limited tissue that we had. We actually had 31 different experiments or different disease systems created for her. And what we're finding and we're improving our techniques on is there are ways to freeze the remainder of those cells so that we can bank them and go back and run additional experiments. So actually Marshall, you know, through Children's National Medical Center and other university hospitals that Marshall has connected us with, is beginning to help us develop relationships so that we can receive livers from multiple patients with multiple diseases in this, you know, rare liver disease space so that we can bank those cells and use them in the future. So liver cells, you can't just grow them. And so you're limited by the amount of tissue that you can get from an organ. On the other hand, our ability to gain greater access to tissue from other patients is really what we need. And as we advance our own technology, we're learning to do experiments with smaller and smaller quantities of cells so that we can maximize the use and productiveness we can get from someone's organ.
So one of the things we're looking to do, too, is develop the equivalent of a biobank for these frozen liver tissues whenever they become available, because these patients are rare. They're scattered all over the globe. So when one becomes available, you can't, you know, it's not necessarily at your convenience. It's when they become available. So for all the different diseases that our liver transplants being done for, we hope to collect as many of these as we can. The nice thing is no risk to the patient. This is something that would have been thrown away otherwise, not just, like I said, thrown in that steel surgical bucket. And we build up that bank of diseases, even if it's not one that HemoSure we are working on, but we can make that available to other investigators in the future when we're starting to look at therapeutic targets. So we hope to build this biological resource that really moves the field along a great way. It's actually been one of the more fun projects I've been involved with.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, let me ask you, Marshall, how does this change when you have a new patient walk in the door, which happens every day?
Sure.
How does this change how you view what you might do for them?
Right now, it doesn't. So, you know, from the standpoint of whether or not we would do it. Exactly. What it does is...
He tells HemoShare to hurry up. You know, I'm trying to treat these patients.
Well, and I'll use one of my young doctors as an example, Dr. Kim Chapman. She's our MD, PhD. I believe she's boarded in adult medicine, pediatrics, biochemical genetics, clinical genetics, and a few other things. So Kim actually works on these organic acidemias. And when Kim joined us up at Children's, I think her biggest frustration was is she did not have enough tools in the box to take care of these patients long term. We could stabilize them. We could, you know, get them to grow, but eventually we knew the clock was working against us. So what Kim's now got a system she can go and start working on. So what does this do from our thought process? It says, okay, we've got maybe some light here at the end of the tunnel. We've got something we can look towards where if we do everything really right here, you know, we can maybe, you know, offer this child a good, long, healthy life. How does that changes first off your whole, you know, kind of feeling about what you're doing, because mm-hmm. you don't feel like you're bailing water out of a leaky boat. You feel like you're actually doing something that's going to make a real difference there. It also means that we look at everything these kids do clinically, and we try to see if that's going to give us a clue that we can then take to this system and test. So what it does is it makes us a little more observant about the little oddities we see here and there in the clinical care on these patients and try to say, okay, is that a clue? And what it's led to is actually another collaboration we're launching now with HemoShare, and I'm going to put on my other hat, which is I work with the National Organization for Rare Diseases, chair of the Scientific and Medical Advisory Committee for them, and we built a program over the last 3 years where patients can enter in data about themselves, about their life history. It's what's called a longitudinal natural history study. And like a lot of things, if you don't know where you've been, you don't know where you're going. You know, it's like history, it's like everything else. And in medicine, this is a huge issue for us. And for these rare diseases, these patients are so uncommon that every treating physician often has a different experience because they may only have one or two patients. And you go from point A to point B, you almost think you're talking about different diseases. So what we did is we created an online registry program for patients where they can log in enter in their own information. We can find out what's happened to them, you know, what drugs they've been on or not been on, you know, what medical complications they had. And what we're going to be doing for these organic acidemias is working with the Organic Acid Association, which is the family patient advocacy group for this disease, actually launching one of these registries within the next year that will collect this data long-term on these patients. So then that gives us another data point. You know, we have this great system where we can look at the cells. Now we'll have this history from our patients that tells us, okay, what are the relevant questions? What do we need to be focusing on? What's really going to hit these patients hard? So it's pulling all of this together into a systems-based research. You know, the word translational research gets beat to death.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it means anymore. But if you're talking about taking things that you're doing at the bench and then carrying it back to a patient very quickly, I think this is going to be one of the best examples of translational research we've seen in a long time.
You know, Jim, I have to laugh. You know, here was Hemishear. Oh, we're so excited about this platform. Looks like it might be good. And then, and now you're like, well, wait a minute. We can actually make therapeutics. Oh, my goodness. But you've got more possibilities and more work to do than you ever set out in the beginning.
There is. And, you know, one of our frustrations is there are so many possibilities, right? But, you know, as a business and, you know, and to prove that we can take a concept, an understanding of a disease, and bring it all the way to a successful therapeutic, you know, that's a significant endeavor and requires a lot of focus because, believe me, many pharmaceutical companies would love, so principles of flow, right? I've just explained earlier, flow matters, right, to human biology, and it's kind of the secret sauce. And so there are countless pharmaceutical companies who would love to see us develop models of the pancreas, the lung, the other organ systems. And in fact, National Cancer Institute is currently supporting us in developing what will probably be the world's first three-dimensional, multi-cell type model, biological model of human tumors in the laboratory. And we've actually made some very good success. The challenge now is we need to focus and work with other partners to help move some of that other work, such as developing the tumor models, and work with a partner to continue that work while we focus more narrowly on this group of liver diseases. So, yeah, the possibilities are endless, Moira, and we could create, you know, a vast, you know, number of diseases, but we've got to be focused.
Well, we've always called this science business, life science business. Now it's life science engineering business. It's like,
yeah.
Put it all together.
You know,
really got something.
I think you remember, I forget what movie it was. You know, you had me when you said hello.
You had me from
well,
hello.
You know, in first describing this science to people in industry and in NIH, when we introduced the concept of bringing engineering methods and combining that with biology, it was like you had me at hello. Because as nascent as we were in understanding the potential of our science, the idea of combining mathematics and fluid dynamics and engineering principles with human biology just made a lot of sense. But it took some very smart people, including the scientists who make up the core of Hemishear, to figure all that out, how to do it. But yeah.
Well, I'm stupefied. You have so much work to do.
We do.
Thank you so much for coming in, and I hope you come back, see us anytime. Now get out of here and get a lot of work done.
All right.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for the time, Maura.
Dr. Marshall Summer is the Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National Medical Center, where he also holds the Margaret O'Malley Chair of Molecular Genetics. Jim Powers is the Chairman and CEO of Hemishear Therapeutics in Charlottesville, Virginia. More information is available at childrensnational.org and hemishear.com. That's hemo, H-E-M-O, shear, S-H-E-A-R, hemishear.com. You're listening to a Biotech Nation special from Tech Nation. Not all biotech startups start up the same way. Inflection Biosciences, headquartered in Dublin, Ireland, has done it a very different way. Darren Cunningham is its CEO, and its first target is lung cancer.
Well, that's right, and that's because that's where the data is pointing us to. We've got these breakthrough treatments that are what we call first in class, or they are unique from an industry point of view, And there is a strong rationale when we look at the data, and the what we call the mechanism of action of the drug is matched very nicely with what's driving lung cancer.
Now, what is unique about these?
So these are, first of all, these are small molecule kinase inhibitors. That's the term for the type of drug that they are. But there are about 450 different types of kinases, and some of those kinases do good things and some do bad things, and many of them have been found to drive cancers. So our particular drug is a unique profile of three different activities, if you want to call it three different kinase inhibition activities, that is unique, as I say, first in class. And that's what sets us apart right now from any other company in the world in this space.
Where'd you get these drugs?
We licensed them in after about a year and a half of searching and screening and looking at speaking to cancer research institutes and universities in the States and Europe. We ultimately licensed our drugs from the National Cancer Research Institute in Spain, or the CNIO. This is a highly prestigious and well-renowned center of excellence from a cancer research point of view.
A lot of times people say we're cancer hunters or we're drug hunters. They usually mean they're sitting in their lab looking for different things. You went out to the world and just looked and looked and looked.
So myself, my business partner is Michael O'Neill, who's the drug development expert. I've got a finance background, but we had this unwritten rule that we didn't want to be just the best biotech in Ireland, or we didn't want to just be developing what happened to be in a university down the road. We wanted to do a global search and find the best opportunity that we could get our hands on and develop that. So that's why it took a year and a half of searching. We looked at 150 opportunities, and that's how we got to where we are today.
So you obtained a pipeline. You got out of that, you picked three to work on together. Mm-hmm. How do you go from here?
So as most biotech CEOs will tell you, that most of what you do is driven by your access to funds. So we are fundraising. And there are many different ways to fund what we're trying to do, be it grants, strategic partnerships, or investors. So once we fund that, we take it right through the next phase and then into early clinical studies. And at that point, we'll be able to see, do we have a real drug opportunity?
And how long have you been in business?
We were incorporated in 2012 in Ireland, but we didn't actually license in the drugs until 2013. So we're 2 years down the road working on these, what we think are groundbreaking treatments.
Many times I speak to startups and they say, yes, well, Dr. Joe was in the lab and he had this really promise. So then he worked with us and we worked with him, and now we all started this startup and carried it forward. You and Michael O'Neill started with a blank sheet of paper.
We certainly did. Neither of us are inventors, investigators. Neither of us worked in the lab, trying to come up with the next treatment. So we were relying on research and discoveries being conducted by other people around the world. Now, the benefit there is that we could choose from the very best. We didn't have to be limited by whatever internal capacity was. And that's what we did. We set up a screen or a checklist of the criteria we felt were important and what would give us a differentiated new treatment opportunity. And with that checklist or that screen, we started knocking on doors and we matched every opportunity up against that checklist. And when we came across the National Cancer Research Center in Spain, it just becomes easier to say CNIO. They had a very rigorous drug development process, which was very impressive. And certainly given Michael's background in big pharma, he was able to recognize immediately that we were dealing with a very serious drug discovery process here. So we straight away started focusing down on that.
Did you start with lung cancer, or was that just one place on your list?
Not at all. First of all, we were agnostic to many things. We just had to make sure that the critical criteria, like the intellectual property, was strong, that they were small molecules rather than biologics for reasons
of
cost.
So that you could, for cost, yeah. And also you could take a pill.
Yes. But in terms of mechanism of action, we were agnostic there too. When I say mechanism of action, I mean how the drug works. We were agnostic from the point of view of that. The only qualifying aspect to that was that we felt we couldn't license in a brand new mechanism that had never been tested before, because for a startup that might be a bit of a hill for us to climb. Equally, we felt we shouldn't be licensing in a mechanism where there was significant amount of competition, because how would we differentiate ourselves? So we wanted something that was, I suppose, in the middle, something where you had some validation, but was sufficiently new where we could have a presence. So that was more of the, you know, the less rigorous, less quantitative part of the screen, more of the qualitative part of the screening process.
Well, obviously you didn't have a big lab built, you didn't have manufacturing, you didn't have sales and distribution, you didn't have a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But that doesn't bother you, right?
Well, for emerging biotech these days, sometimes it's better not to have so much internal infrastructure. It allows you to be more capital efficient. So you can actually now rely. It's the same way. Why would you make a movie when you can rent a movie, right? You can rely on the expertise of vendors across the world and pick the very best vendors that match up to what you need to get done at a particular point in time. And when you're finished with that particular piece of work, you're not left with the infrastructure that you might have built. Otherwise, you can just move on to the next thing. So we can be efficient in how we do things by accessing third-party resources. So no need to have extensive in-house sales and marketing, manufacturing, or research capabilities.
So you keep looking at your checklist.
We do. Well, now that we've done the now that we've executed the in-licensing, the focus has now moved from looking at the checklist. We're now focused on the correct and smart development of our lead drug, which we've now identified will be applied in lung cancer initially. And we're going to raise funds and bring that through into the clinic and generate data. And if we can show a response in lung cancer patients who right now have no treatment options, apart possibly from chemo, and where their lifespan post-diagnosis is measured in months, if we can show a response to our agent in those subgroups, we will certainly attract attention at that point.
Well, Darren, this is terrific. Please come back. Keep us updated.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you very much for having me.
Darren Cunningham is the CEO of Inflection Biosciences. More information is available on the web at inflectionbio.com. For those listening earlier to our interview with Dr. Marshall Sommer, the Division Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National Medical Center, and Jim Powers, the Chairman and CEO of HemoShear Therapeutics, more information is available at childrensnational.org and hemoshear.com. That's hemo, H-E-M-O, shear, S-H-E-A-R, hemoshear.com. For Tech Nation and for Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcorn.